The Mahatma or saint is the second in a series, Living the Bhagavad Gita Way by Swami Surya Devananda. Dedicated to Gurudev Swami Shivananda. This series is based on the translation and arrangement of verses in the book Gita Meditations by Swami Shivananda, published by the Divine Life Society, Rishikesh, India. This series is a study of a better way of living based on the teachings of the Bhagavad Gita. I am grateful to the Divine Life Society for their permission to use Gita Meditations by Swami Shivananda, whose translation and flow we will follow. Prayer is the foundation and pivot of spiritual life. When you pray, you must feel your relationship with God. It is from there that you will relate or commune. For most, the relationship will evolve as you evolve spiritually. Let us start our daily sessions with some prayers.
O adorable Lord of mercy and love, salutations and prostrations unto Thee. Thou art omnipresent, omnipotent, and omniscient. Thou art Satchidananda, existence, consciousness, bliss, absolute. Thou art the indweller of all beings. Grant us an understanding heart, equal vision, balanced mind, faith, devotion, and wisdom. Grant us inner spiritual strength to resist temptation and to control the mind. Free us from egoism, lust, greed, hatred, and anger. Fill our hearts with divine virtues. Let us behold Thee in all these names and forms. Let us serve Thee in all these names and forms. Let us ever remember Thee. Let us ever sing Thy glories. Let Thy name be ever on our lips. Let us abide in Thee forever and ever. Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti.
Brahmanandam Paramasukadam Kevalam Jnanamurtim Dvandvatitam Gaganasadrisham Tattvamasya Dilakshim Ekam Nityam Vimalamachalam Sarvadi Sakshibhutam Bhavatitam Trigunaraitam Sadgurum Tam Namami. I prostrate to that Sadguru, the Brahman, who is bliss, who is the giver of supreme happiness, who is absolute knowledge, who is beyond the pair of opposites, who is vast like the ether, who is attained through assertions like Tattvamasi, who is one, eternal, and changeless, the witness of the mind, who transcends all changes and modifications, who is devoid of the three modes of Prakriti. Vasudevam sutam devam kamsachanur mardhanam Devaki paramanandam krishnam vande jagat gurum. I salute Lord Krishna, the world teacher, the son of Vasudeva, the destroyer of Kamsa and Chanur, the supreme bliss of Devaki. Om Tat Sat Purushottamam Samgaram Shantam Vyat Sannibham Maya Titam Khanda Bodha Paramananda Atmaratnakaram Vishwasthite Yudhyantam Ekritam Tridaiva Bhantam Vibham Satyam Jnanam Anantakoti Nihir Jyoti Swarupam Bhaje. I take refuge in that one immortal Purushottama, who is known as Om Tat Sat, who is the Guru of all, who is peaceful and all-pervading like ether, who transcends Maya, who is the ocean of the indivisible consciousness and the supreme bliss of the Self. who is the beginning, the middle, and the end of the universe, who, the one Lord, appears as though he is threefold, who is truth, knowledge, and massive effulgence, like endless crores of suns put together. Sarvo Upanishado Gavo Dugdha Gopala Nandana Partho Vatsa Sudhir Bhokta Dugdham Gita Amritam Mahate. All the Upanishads are the cows. The milker is Krishna, the cowherd boy. Arjuna is the calf. Men of purified intellect are the drinkers. The milk is the great nectar of the Gita. Om Sahana Vavatu Sahana Bhunaktu Sahaviryam Karvavahai Tejasvinavadhitamastu Mavidvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Om. May he protect us both, teacher and pupil. May he cause us both to enjoy the bliss of mukti. May we both exert to find out the true meaning of the scriptures. May our studies be fruitful. May we never quarrel with each other. Om peace, om peace, om peace. In the previous session, we covered the nature of God and the individual. Still, the heart struggles to accept that a direct experience of this is possible for the common man. The Bhagavad Gita does not ask you to accept anything blindly, telling you instead that many of different dispositions have experienced the truth, and you can experience it as well. The problem is that this experience is not had by adding on. Usually, when we want to experience something, we get it. We get something or learn something. It is a sort of add-on. But this experience is unique. It is had by letting go of all that limits, because the truth is ever-existent. And this is why it is difficult, because we may not be able to do this. It's something completely new. To let go of all limiting adjuncts till individuality is let go and the universal shines in its own bright light. Today, the theme is the Mahatma or saint. These are those great ones that have trodden this path and realized it, though their means may be different. We start with the Bhagavata. The Bhagavata is a devotee. Then we move on to the state of Sthitapragna. Sthitapragna is one whose wisdom is steady. Next to Yoga Bhrashta, sometimes translated as one who has fallen in yoga, but perhaps a better definition of it is one who has just not reached the mark as yet. Then on to Gunatita. Gunatita is one who has mastery over the gunas. Gunas are modes of the mind, or frequencies of the mind, or different ways in which the mind operates. And lastly, to the nature of equal vision, which is a sum of all the four that we have talked about earlier. The 12th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita is the chapter on the yoga of devotion. Arjuna asks about the better way between the yoga of devotion and the yoga of knowledge. By knowledge, we are not talking about an academic or scholarly prowess, but rather a discipline by which one seeks to know without any support through direct intuition or meditation. This is the path of knowledge, a very difficult path, as the requirements of the seeker are very high. Krishna therefore extols the yoga of devotion as the better way, as it is easier and accessible by most.
And why is it easier? Because there is a lot of support, external support, in the path of devotion. See, my friends, you could sing kirtan and you have your kirtan by which the devotion in your heart can begin to flow. You could worship, ritual worship, and through the process and the things that you've used, whether they be flowers and candles or whatever, you could bring about your devotion and let it flow. So in the path of devotion, you have a lot of external support. And since most of what we do in life requires some form of external support, at work, in the family, at home, it is something that is related to easier. In the path of knowledge, there is no support. What you know must be meditated upon and entered into till there is a direct experience of the truth. So the mind is purified with the mind, and the mind is pierced to puncture it and go through it to the substratum by that purified mind. This is a very steep path nowadays, my friends, because the mind is distracted, our concerns are many, and most are not able to dedicate full time towards their spiritual adventure. So now we arrive at some questions. Who is a devotee, and what does it mean to be devoted? In the Bhagavad Gita, love and devotion are synonymous. A Bhagavata is one who loves God, and by love, we mean one who is devoted to God. Let us look at these two verses. Those who, fixing their mind on me, worship me, ever steadfast, and endowed with supreme faith, these are the best in yoga, in my opinion. But to those who worship me, renouncing all actions in me, regarding me as the supreme goal, meditating on me with single-minded yoga. Let's talk about the first one first, and look at what it means to be a devotee. To be a devotee means to be devoted. And to be devoted means to give yourself completely to something. When you say he's a devoted family man, you know that he gives himself completely to his family. His family means the world to him. So here, when we talk about being a devotee, it's an easy thing to talk about. Well, I'm a devotee. I'm not a gyani or a raja yogi. I don't meditate because I'm a bhakta. I'm a devotee. I've heard people say this countless times. But a devotee is one who is devoted. Are you devoted? Have you given yourself completely to the ideal, not just in your puja area or your worship time, but when you get up, that you are remembering God and practicing the presence of Him, which means that all things that are self-centered, selfish, personal gain are completely out of the picture. That's what it means. And we are going to come to some of those as we talk later. This is especially important today to be devoted, as the minds are most distracted with an over-reliance on technology by which one can access anything at any time. This changes the nature of the mind and makes it want to jump from one to another till it finds what it likes. And though technology can be very useful, overuse and misuse can degrade the quality of the mind severely. Now let us talk a little bit about worship. Worship is adoration of God by which or in which it must have love as its basis. You cannot have adoration without love, and you cannot have worship without adoration. So, you have to discipline yourself to prevent any external disturbances. Give a few examples. Today, you often see when people sit to worship, either in their homes or a place of worship, they absolutely refuse to be without their electronic leashes, whether it's your phone or device or something else, and they feel that it is okay. And if anyone tells them that this is not allowed here, that person is a show spoiler. This, my friends, is a very pitiable state of inner degradation. Worship requires that same dedication, that same devotion, because it is an act of love. And love cannot have other loves while it is taking place, because then it is not wholehearted. To those whose minds are set on me, O Arjuna, verily, I become ere long the savior from the ocean of samsara. Sounds beautiful. But Krishna is very specific in mentioning, to those whose minds are set on me, before he mentions, I become the savior. So the bar or the threshold is very clear, without ambiguity. To have one's mind set on something means to give it your full attention. Now you can see that this means without any distraction at all. And to be able to do this, you have to first learn how to do all things, however mundane, however menial you may consider them, with the same value. Otherwise, you will not be able to set your mind on God. This word set is very important. When you make yogurt at home, you mix in some culture into hot milk that has cooled a little and keep it in a cool, dry place. The yogurt sets in the form of milk. Only when you practice being undisturbed, like that yogurt that has been placed there to set, undisturbed or undistracted in all things, can you understand what set on me means. He who hates no creature, who is friendly and compassionate to all, who is free from attachment and egoism, balanced in pleasure and pain, and forgiving. If you are devoted to a certain goal, you are not going to quit when trials and tribulations come along. Similarly, when one is devoted to an ideal, there is no compromise. The ideal here is God, who is omnipresent. With this, how can hatred, unfriendliness, pride, and grudges come into play? But we also see that one must be free from attachment and balanced, not only in pain, but in pleasure also. How does one stay balanced in pleasure? Why is it not possible to enjoy the simple pleasures that come naturally without craving for more or for a repetition? Does craving for repetition or more or to prolong the pleasure have any connection with enjoying the pleasure on hand or at present? Think about it. So this is a package deal which says all or nothing. Devotion, which is love, is free from attachment. Think about this also. What does love have to do with attachment? Are there loving people who are not attached? Have you met some of them? Do you know some of them? Does one necessitate another? Actually, attachment smothers love, interferes with love. Think about it. So it is also here from losing balance in pleasure and pain. Usually, we bundle love, attachment, love, pleasure, and all of these. Here, we are asked to be free of both of them for love to be. Ever content, steady in meditation, self-controlled, possessed of firm conviction, with the mind and intellect offered to me, he, my devotee, is dear to me. We have already talked about this word, devotee, and what it means to be devoted, meaning to give oneself completely to that which you are devoted, your full and uncompromising attention. Full means zero leakage, not only physically, but by your attention. Your entire mind and heart, along with your body, is facing that to which you are devoted. If you are devoted, meditation should come naturally, as meditation is also devotion. In meditation, you are giving yourself to the object of meditation, or you are giving your complete attention to your object of meditation. In devotion, you are giving your complete attention to your ideal, but you have a little bit of support. You have a little bit of a few tools like kirtan and puja and a few other things. In meditation, it is supportless. So, this in devotion, you have the use of as much support as you may need. In ritual worship, there are the implements of worship and the sequence you may follow. This is what makes it easy, as the mind is goaded on with the other sense organs, which are used to bring about a concentration of the mind. He who neither rejoices nor hates, nor grieves nor desires, renouncing good and evil, and who is full of devotion, is dear to me. We are now told that we must be free from hate, grief, desire, and renounce both good and evil in order to be devoted. You can somehow understand the rest, but to be free from grief, for there to be devotion or love, we grieve when things change, when people go away, even if it is just for a couple hours, to school, let's say, and our hearts get heavy. But when you accept God as all and in all, as God is, sincerely and earnestly in your heart, you will at once be free of grief, as God indwells all and all rests in Him. So what is there to grieve about? But I do want to talk about this good and evil right now, renouncing good and evil. What makes something good and evil? There are a lot of things in yesterday's times that were seemed, or some years ago, that were okay, that were good and acceptable. And in today's world or in today's times, they seem to be outdated or not quite as acceptable. So the idea of good and evil is a very difficult concept, my friend, and mostly subjective, depending on where you're looking at it. A philosopher might have quite a different sense of what is good and evil. A social worker may have a different sense of what is good and evil. So it's all quite different and depends upon where we look at. And that I from where we look at is the sense of ego. Your true self does not have any of this, because all opposites are perfectly reconciled, because it is the self of all the opposites as well. So this good and evil mechanism, which is called raga dvesha, based on likes and dislikes, is the outer circle, the hub of which is the I or the ego. And this is why we are asked to give up all these things, neither hates nor grieves nor desires, renouncing good and evil. And what do? Instead, full of devotion is dear to me. Now this doesn't mean that you're sitting in your prayer area all day long from morning till night. But in your prayer area, you are devoted, which means you give yourself completely to. And even when you go about your normal business and your normal work, you never forget that God indwells all. And therefore, vices and selfishness and rudeness and callousness never enter your heart. You are ever willing to help, ever willing, ever there with a kind smile, and helping hand. And so this verse has a lot packed into it in those couple lines. He who is the same to foe and friend, and also in honor and dishonor, who is the same in cold and heat, and in pleasure and pain, who is free from attachment. He to whom censure and praise are equal, who is silent, content with anything, homeless, of a steady mind, and full of devotion. That man is dear to me. These verses raise the bar even higher, saying that one must have sameness in attitude, which means that any form of favoritism, preference, or priority cannot be, not even to those who are referred to often as our people, our kith, or our kin. Our people is the absence of sameness. We have heard free from attachment earlier, a few verses ago. It has just resurfaced again in just 5 verses. So you can understand the importance of being free of attachment for devotion or true love to be. Now I'd like to talk about one important word in these verses, homeless. We are told more about sameness in other contexts and introduced to this word, homeless. Does this mean that one has to be out on the street, wandering about, perhaps on a park bench? When we say a homeless person, that is usually what may come to mind, a person without a brick and mortar home of his own. But here, I feel homeless is one who is at home everywhere. He is not more homey, one place is not more homey than the other. To be at home everywhere is another requirement of the acceptance of God's omnipresence. Because wherever you go, He is. That is what omnipresence means. You are moving about or residing in Him only. And so naturally, since God or your ideal is everywhere, you should be at home everywhere. And when you have that sameness in attitude that we spoke about to all, not just to our people or a particular group, you are never dissatisfied with one and more satisfied with the other. You are not more accepting of one and less accepting of the other. The mind becomes same and it sees equal value in all things. Friends, you have to lift your hearts and mind and understanding to a very high degree to rise to what the Gita calls devotion. I have heard some people say, this meditation stuff is not for me. I am a devotee. Very good. Excellent. Congratulations. But what is a devotee? One who is devoted. One who gives himself completely to his ideal. And what do we do in meditation? You give yourself completely to your objective meditation. So there cannot be devotion without meditation, and there cannot be meditation without devotion. The essence is the same, they just appear different. Their tools are different. Devotion has support, and meditation has much less support. So back to these people, they say, well, this is not for me, that is not for me, and I am this. But they still worry and grieve, and their complaint box is full, always trying to get some relief from the fires that scorch them. Where is devotion? If you have surrendered, if there is real devotion, you should no longer have any worries, because you rest in Him, you have surrendered to Him, and you are His responsibility. Devotion, my friends, means to be devoted. Understand very clearly in your mind's eye what it means to be devoted. And we will talk a little bit more about this as we go along. Now, we talk about the state of Stitha Prajna. A Stitha Prajna is a person of steady wisdom. What good is it to know a lot about elevating philosophy if it does not elevate us irreversibly? Book knowledge is one thing, and words or impressive oration can come from it. Real knowledge, my friends, is another thing, and life flows from it, and it flows into life. Book knowledge will not help you in life. The people in this camp find themselves often talking about my regular or work life and my spiritual life as they are unable to reconcile them, and so their wisdom is not steady or established. It does not endure in our day-to-day life. These verses tell us about the state of one whose wisdom is steady, a Stitha Prajna, or one established in wisdom. In simple words, to be steady in wisdom or to be established in wisdom is what you know is what lives life. The wisdom you know is what responds to life naturally. I cannot know all these high philosophy and high topics and live life differently. Then what I know is not worth anything because it doesn't enter life. Let's look at these verses. When a man completely casts off, O Arjuna, all the desires of the mind, and when his self is satisfied in the self, then he is said to be one of steady wisdom. He whose mind is not shaken by adversity, who does not hanker after pleasures, and who is free from attachment, fear, and anger, is called a sage of steady wisdom. See, my friends, book knowledge comes about by a sort of accumulation. It is not learning. Cramming or remembering some words that can be repeated in a soft and impressive voice to show someone your learning capacity, that helps your earning capacity. Sounds alike, doesn't it? Real knowledge, my friends, comes from renunciation, getting rid of what doesn't belong. Just like a sculptor, to reveal the statue, he doesn't add on, but chisels away what doesn't belong to reveal what he had already seen in his mind's eye. That chiseling away is the renunciation that reveals true knowledge. When one lives an examined life, one sees each moment and situation for what it is. In this vigilant living, false notions ascribed to people, things, and conditions fall away. One sees that desire is not about things or things, but an operation of our own mind, and pursuing any form of desire is like a dog chasing its own tail. When one sees this very clearly, desires fall away naturally by themselves, and there is peace and contentment. Again, these do not come by any form of getting things or making it in life, but by looking at the value that we have infused in things and realizing that they are not part of things. Then the pursuit of things stops and there is peace and contentment. As long as one is in the chasing mode, there is no peace or contentment. Renunciation, however, requires one to live life as duty. When one lives life intelligently thus, one learns not to hanker after things, but to be concerned with one's duty instead. Do all that needs to be done with the very best effort possible, and let come what may. You don't reject, you don't push what comes, but that is not why you're doing it. The purpose of work is to be worked on. You do all work, including your career, for self-purification. And when you do it hard, you work hard with all of your intelligence and all of your might, you will not have to worry about going hungry. It will come. You need not chase after it. There is peace in doing and contentment with what comes. Nowhere in the process of the action and its fruition is there loss of peace, as the heart and mind stay with the action. When the heart and mind are not with the action, there is no peace even while doing. They are never ahead or in anticipation of what comes, because you are concerned with doing. Let it come. So when there is no anticipation, there is no fear. It may come, it may not come. And when there is no fear, there is no anger. Can you see the beauty of this, my friends? Examine it for yourself. When you anticipate anything, there's always the possibility of it not resulting. And this snowballs into fear. If you continue to put effort and the result becomes even more improbable, you feel dissatisfied at first. And then a sort of anger arises out of frustration or helplessness at not being able to make it happen. And my friends, just who is behind all of this? Look at it yourself, and you will see that it is as meaningless and a downward spiral to have any expectations at all. Now, this does not mean that you become cold or dejected with things, but rather you get fired up, because when you are free from expectations, you have all the energy that was going to expectations and adjustments, and you can channel them into doing. It is now that your productivity will increase. It is now that your creativity will maximize, and it will now that you will have higher chances of a higher success. You cannot know real effort till you have had every drop of energy going into the work on hand. And this is not just about your job, but about any and every effort. He who is everywhere without attachment, who neither rejoices nor despises on meeting with anything, good or bad, his wisdom is established. We have a couple very important themes out here. We come again to the theme of homelessness. To be everywhere without attachment is the same thing as to be at home everywhere or homeless. This is the homelessness that the Bhagavad Gita talks about. See, my friends, renunciation, homelessness, all these things are very different in the Bhagavad Gita. Attachment to one thing or anything or any condition is an invitation to sorrow, as all things are in the process of change. People, things, and conditions come into view, change, and then go away from view. It is the biggest recycling or green project you can think of. But really, nothing comes and goes. It just appears to do so because of the new look it takes on. Why do we feel that love has anything at all to do with attachment? We've spoken about this earlier. And we know that attachment is not even possible, and that there is no rationale in it. We've just talked about this. When attachments are seen through, they are dispensed with. And if one is unable to dispense with it, wisdom has not arisen, and one is still not capable of leading an examined life by choice. When attachments are dispensed, the ebb and tide of rejoicing when things go our way and feeling dejected when things don't go our way also stops. The fluctuation in the mind slows down, and there is a state of inner silence. There is peace, and one's wisdom gets established. This state of silence doesn't mean that there's no activity in the mind, but when the mind is to be used, there is movement in the mind. And when there is nothing to think about, the mind sits quietly like a car in a garage that can be pulled out when you need it, and when you don't need it, it simply sits. When the mind becomes like that, the mind becomes peaceful, the mind becomes silent, and one's wisdom is established. When, like the tortoise, which withdraws its limbs on all sides, he withdraws his senses from the sense objects, then his wisdom becomes steady. Having restrained them all, he should sit steadfast, intent on me. His wisdom is steady, whose senses are under control. Therefore, O Arjuna, his knowledge is steady, whose senses are completely restrained from the sense objects. Sense control and self-control are brought into practice through the single but double-sided action of vairagya and abhyasa, which is dispassion and right application or right effort. It is hard to wean oneself from undesirable habits if one does not give the same energy that is flowing there a new and positive or desired flow. See, my friends, when you face the darkness, you don't see the light. When you face the light, you don't see a shadow or darkness. Now, why should one struggle with turning away from darkness if one faces the light? When you face the light, you automatically turn your back towards darkness. You turn your back on your shadow. You no longer see it. So if you face that which is right, that which is good, that which is conducive, you automatically turn your back on that which you would like to leave, habits that you would like to leave, vices that you would like to leave, or shallower ways of thinking that you would like to leave. And where is the struggle in this? The struggle comes when you would like to leave something, but you are not wholeheartedly prepared, willing, and enthusiastic to face the new. You must want to face the new first before you turn away from the old, because facing the new or facing the good is turning away from that which is not good or the old. You must understand this to understand it's a downward spiral to struggle with things. Why look over your shoulder and sigh? Gee, I wonder what will happen to those folks when you, or if you have to turn away from some people to turn into something else. Say you know people and they've changed or you've changed and it's no longer your cup of tea. And you still think, gee, I wonder what will happen to these folk who are or were connected with me. Why are you concerned about that? Let things work out how they will work out. What is your involvement in what you or you have found non-conducive? If you have found something conducive, you simply face that. Each one is making his own choices as they go along. They choose to stay with what they find conducive. You have to choose to stay with what you find conducive. As long as you look back over the rearview mirror, you are looking back. And when you're looking back, you don't look forward. And when you don't look forward, there is struggle because you haven't embraced the new. You are still holding on to the old and something wants to move forward, but you are still in love with the old. You have to understand this carefully. This is the dynamics of struggle. Sense control and self-control are the pivot that will make one human. These two qualities are essential for self-cultivation and inner blossoming. Parents who have learned some lessons in life will make it a point to instill them in children from early on if they truly wish for their highest welfare. Children brought up without these sense control and self-control will find it very hard in their adult years to install them or to instill them. Now, my friends, we shift gears once again and go to our third topic for the day, Yoga Bhrashta. The spiritual path has many ups and downs as we stumble now and again to our lower nature, force of habit, and weakness of personality. It may seem that it is a stiff and uphill climb, and perhaps there is more to lose than to gain. But these verses that on the screen assure us that there is no loss in yoga, only gain. Once on the path, it does not matter if you fall, as long as you pick yourself up and keep going. The price of not walking on the path is way greater than the sum total of all the falls experienced. O Arjuna, neither in this world nor in the next world is there destruction for him. None verily who does good, O my son, ever comes to grief. Having attained to the worlds of the righteous, and having dwelt there for everlasting years or many millennia, he who was unsuccessful in yoga is reborn in a house of the pure and spiritually wealthy. Or, he is born in a family of even the wise yogi. Verily, a birth like this is very difficult to obtain in this world. There, he comes in touch with the knowledge acquired in his former body and strives more than before for perfection, O Arjuna. By that very form of practice, he is born on in spite of himself. Even he who merely wishes to know yoga goes beyond the Shabda Brahman or definitions and the ritual of the Veda. But the yogi who strives with diligence, purified of sins, and perfected gradually through many births, reaches the goal. Now, my friends, a yoga bhrashta is one who has not been able to attain perfection. Not as yet. If for whatever reason we have not been able to reach the goal, there is no loss, as every big brick in our effort stays in place and we keep moving on from where we left off. There is no loss in our effort, as it is brought back to life, just like seeds lying dormant in a drought come back to life at the first rainfall. We all make mistakes on the path, and they can be good teachers. To avoid making mistakes, take intelligent practice and intelligent living. There are four things I would suggest to you that would reduce mistakes or errors or minimize them. 1. A firm conviction in the ideal. This conviction is not just intellectually, but in your heart also. This must be what you want. Not just because what you've heard about it or you should be doing it, but you find it fulfilling. You find it satisfying. You must find your ideal as satisfying you fully. When something satisfies you fully, you don't window shop, you don't look around. There are many people who are satisfied fully in their marriage and their relationship, and it's strong. There's no reason to look around. There's no reason to waste time anywhere else. So this firm conviction in the ideal, your ideal must be thoroughly satisfying. Thoroughly satisfying. 2, a good set of principles and precepts for living in such a way that supports the goal. Because obviously, satisfying, as we talked about earlier, firm conviction in the ideal, has to now enter life. And life requires some precepts that you have very clear, which are sort of like rules for living. Principles are a little bit broader. Precepts are a little bit more clearly defined. I won't do this. I won't lie. I won't cheat. When you are very clear, when I come to this crossroads, right or left, right being not cheating, left being cheating a little bit, I go right. And so when you do come to them, you go right, because you've gone over it in your mind very clearly and made that precept, when I come to the crossroads of left being cheating a little and right being honest and truthful or non-cheating, I go right. You have to have this clarity of what you would do in moments of choice, and therefore choice is obviated. Number three, a leak-proof plan for living. I go to work, I do this, I come back, I go for a walk or get some exercise or do whatever it is, catch up on a couple things. I spend some time reading to energize my mind, broaden my intellect. I spend some time in meditation, in prayer, in things like that. By having this, you don't keep yourself at the whims and fancies and sudden phone calls. Hey, let's go here. Oh, I was going to do this, but okay, since you've called, I can always do that later. You cut all that out, that weakness out. Why? It's easy. If you are satisfied completely in your ideal. And who has set your ideal? You have. Who has set your goal? You have. So you're backing yourself only. And if you don't back yourself, who is going to back you? And last of all, a system of self-accountability, which might include intelligent self-punishment. Let me start at the opposite end of intelligent self-punishment. It doesn't mean you beat yourself or something like that. That is utterly foolish, my friends. If you've done something by which you've skipped, say, your meditation time, well, it's easy to skip your dinner, maybe just have a half a glass of milk instead, and say, I'm going to use that 20 minutes for a little bit more japa or a little bit more meditation. You send a message to your mind that this is not acceptable, and you're willing to correct it regardless of the means. When you do that, you stop making mistakes because you're in charge again. Mistakes are not the problem. Not learning from them and not trying to avoid them is. It is this that can lead to a fallen state or a state where one has lost his way. The grip of old habits and weaknesses can take hold with redoubled vigor, so much so that one would feel they have lost their way or is drifting. Drifting is when you lose the ideal and focus of your goal. It is a very difficult state, my friends, and the best thing you can do if you are drifting is to ground yourself somehow and start with the basics again. Make a rigid schedule, japa at this time, this at this time. No time for heroics or basics, or join if you have a good satsang group or something, and start with the support of that. You have to be very down to earth to realize what is going on. Any condition can be recovered from if there is a will. All the good that you have done before is ready to help you now, if you will follow the path that they point to. To keep your orientation or your compass always pointing to the good is a skill that must be cultivated. Gunas are modes of the mind. Oh, by the way, we've just ventured into a new topic. And a gunatita is one who has mastery over these modes. The mind has three modes: sattva, which is purity, balance, light, and helpful to the spiritual path. And the other two, rajas, which is dynamism, which often results in passions and very strong feelings about things. And tamas, which is laziness, heedlessness, ignorance, darkness, and sloth. Tamas hides the truth or what is good, and rajas goads you to find peace, happiness, and joy in the things outside. Tamas also hides the joy, and rajas says, it comes from there, it comes from there, let's get it. These verses tell us about the qualities of one who has mastery over the gunas, or a gunatita. Light, activity, and illusion. When they are present to Arjuna, he hates them not, nor does he long for them when they are absent. Swami Sivananda was very fond of reminding seekers, you must know what gunas are operating in you each moment. Gunas are modes of the mind or frequencies of energy flow in the mind. Let us take the example of a body of water in which water flows like a little stream differently throughout the day and on which we depend on for our water supply. And let us start talking about tamas first. Tamas. When there is no flow of water, it starts to get stagnant. Mold and other forms of algae grow, and there is limited visibility. You cannot see the bottom and never know just how deep it is and the contour of the bottom. When tamas operates in the mind, similarly, it hides the truth and promotes lethargy, dullness of mind, and indecision. Now let us talk about rajas. When the water level and speed increases, there can be a spillover and flooding on the banks. Water takes the path of least resistance and rushes in those areas. This is what happens, my friends, in the mind too, when rajas or dynamism operates. The speed of the flow of energy increases and it tends to want to flow to the low areas or the areas of weakness or any vices or shortcomings that you may have. You have to be especially watchful, as this can happen when there are outer conditions that are conducive to acting out, or even worse, when there are no outer conditions. You might think about why I say it's worse when there are no outer conditions. See, when there are outer conditions, we are a little bit guarded. You know, the consequences of getting angry can be you may get fired from your job, or it may break a friendship or whatever, and you may be guarded because of that. But when there are no outer conditions, say you're thinking of someone and you get angry, you may bubble internally. There's nobody to see you, nobody to react, no price tag to be paid. You may think it's a free ride and my birthright to get angry. So you bubble inside and you create the image of the person inside, and anger starts from your mind and it ends on your mind. Being that it starts from your mind, as it does, all anger, fear, etc., all start within our mind, and it pours onto your mind the image of that person, because that person is not here, you get a double experience of anger, and anger increases. This is what happens when we bubble internally. So this drama has heavy consequences, my friends. Just subduing it and going through the urge mentally is very dangerous. You have to be careful about it. So when rajas operates in the mind, it points to what is not accurate, true, or good, and goads you into action, whether there are people and conditions or whether you are by yourself. All vices become magnets for rajas, just as water seeks its own level or the lowest level. And the increased speed of psychic energy's flow rushes into those low-lying areas, and one feels compelled to act in spite of knowing the consequences. Now, my friends, we talk about sattva. When the water level is just right, there is no turbulence, nor is there stagnation. The water is clear and clean. You can drink from it, see through it, and the water becomes most useful. When sattva operates in the mind, there is a good balance and harmony. We see things clearly for what they are and consider the pros and cons before acting. Sattva is especially conducive for study and meditation. It is the duty of every person to increase his sattva through all that he does, as sattva is inner or natural goodness. He who, seated like one unconcerned, is not moved by the qualities, and who, knowing that the qualities are active, is self-centered and moves not, is a gunatita. Alike in pleasure and pain, who dwells in the self, to whom a clod of earth, stone and gold are alike, to whom the dear and the unfriendly are alike, firm, the same in censure and praise, the same in honor and dishonor, the same to friend and foe, abandoning all undertakings, he is said to have crossed the qualities. These verses have to do with inner balance or samatva. To see things alike does not mean that one is foolish in seeing gold and a cloud of earth as the same thing literally. One sees gold as gold, understands its value, and knows what is the best use for it or the best thing to be done with it. One sees earth or a stone for what it is and knows what can be done with it. With this gold is worth so much and I can use it to help this village. They've had a bad harvest of these poor people and it can be put to use that way. This good stone can make a good grinding stone. I've been looking for one and I'll take it back to my cottage and make a grinding stone out of it. The stone has its use, gold has its use. The key thing here is you are not moved positively by gold and you are not repelled by a big stone in your path. What is this? Why is this here? Who kept this here? This piece of whatever. So that reaction, inner reaction to them is the same. Gold has its use. A big stone or a clod of earth has its use. Gold cannot do what a clod of earth can do, and a clod of earth cannot do what gold can do. Both have their use, each useless when the other is required. The important thing is that the type of balance that is suggested in a likeness or sameness is not to be moved positively when one sees gold and negatively when one sees a clod of earth. Because the value that one sees is not part of the seen. The value of gold is in our minds. The value of a clod of earth is in our mind. A farmer sees great value in good earth or good soil. And if we react to the values in our own mind, we are reacting to our mind rather than what is out there. And this is a problem in spiritual life. And that's why Krishna talks again later in honor and dishonor. What do we consider as honor and dishonor? Sometimes the things that we consider, the values are within our own mind. To be the same to friend and foe. What makes someone a friend and what makes someone a foe? I see him as a friend or her as a friend and they are my friend. I see someone as a foe. Now, does that mean you treat everyone absolutely the same, plain Jane? Not really. Let's take the example of visiting a zoo. When you visit a zoo, often in many zoos, they have a children's zoo up front where they have animals that they can pet, gentle animals. Now, a bunny rabbit in there, for instance, could be petted. And it's perfectly okay with the bunny rabbit. But you're not going to pet that big 6 foot or 7 foot python or that tiger. The bunny rabbit may be petted, but that tiger and snake, it's better to keep your distance. Does that mean you love the bunny rabbit and hate the tiger or snake? No, my friends, they just have a different nature. One can be approached. One, it's better to keep your distance. So also, there are difficult people in this world. And it is better perhaps to be a little formal and keep your distance, but not out of hatred, not out of malice, not out of disgust. And there are people that are friendly and approachable, but you don't cling to them out of attachment. Our reaction to things out there is what is important. Now, my friends, we come to the fifth or last topic for today. The nature of equal vision. Whatever path you choose as your mainstay, be it the way of devotion, the way of yoga, or the way of knowledge, equal vision is requisite. Seeing, feeling, and acting with equal vision is the mark of a sage, as he indeed sees sameness everywhere, which to him is the omnipresence of God. These verses extol the nature of equal vision and one who has equal vision. Sages look with an equal eye on a Brahmana endowed with learning and humility, on a cow, on an elephant, and even on a dog and an outcast. Even here, birth is overcome by those whose minds rest in sameness. Brahman is spotless indeed and sameness. Therefore, they are established in Brahman. Again, we see an emphasis on sameness, which is equal vision in simpler terms. That which is sought is one and uniform, and the seeker must rise to the quality of the sought, as the seeker does not stand outside the sought. There is no instrument other than oneself for the quest of self-realization. There are differences in appearances, but in essence, all is perfectly synthesized in oneness or sameness. Unless you overcome the limitation of equal vision in your day-to-day life, you cannot overcome it in meditation. In meditation, different thoughts arise and fall in the same consciousness, appearing so very real that something wants to react to it, and the awareness or consciousness is pulled to identify with that which wants to react. Now, my friends, all this is happening while we are fully aware and intently looking at what is going on. The instrument of the mind for meditation is cultivated when you are not sitting and meditating. It is cultivated in life. So this means that even when you are not sitting and meditating, you are required to still be meditating, which means watching the mind. This, my friends, is called vigilance, a state where the mind is observed relentlessly. It is also called vicharana. Unless you bring yourself to do this, meditation will be difficult to impossible. The sages obtain absolute freedom or moksha. They whose sins have been destroyed, whose perception of dualities is torn asunder, who are self-controlled and intent on the welfare of all beings. He who is of the same mind to the good-hearted, friends, enemies, the indifferent, the neutral, the hateful, the relatives, the righteous, and the unrighteous, excels. With the mind harmonized by yoga, he sees the self abiding in all beings and all beings abiding in the self. He sees the same everywhere. He who, through the likeness of the self, O Arjuna, sees sameness everywhere, be it pleasure or pain, he is regarded as the highest yogi. When there is unremitting and relentless vigilance, one sees that the idea of essential difference in all things is nothing but the values that reside in our own mind. There are differences in appearance, yes, but not in its not essential differences. When the mechanism that sees essential difference is abandoned, a different vision, which has always been there, but submerged, obscured, and not used, comes into play. One is able to see things just as they are, to be able to see what appears different, feels different, smells different, tastes different, and sounds different, but to know that the differentiation too is the reaction of the senses, which are limited, working through the sense organs, which are also limited, and synthesized by the mind, which is also limited. All differentiation is limitation, working within limitation, and being seen by limitation. It does not matter what path in yoga becomes your mainstay. Equal vision is requisite. Each path reaches this differently and is best for different makeups. It is good to have a well-balanced practice, as it also makes equal vision easier to attain by giving you the most or the best of many approaches. Krishna tells us that when there is equal vision, one is regarded as the highest sage or the highest yogi. Equal vision is not a something you do as a skill or selectively. It is when the passion of rajas in the mind is squeezed out, and though things appear different, there is no fuel in the mind to react to them as different, as there is mastery over the gunas. Friends, our theme today has been the Mahatma or saint, and we have talked about a good many things. A Bhagavata is a devotee. But before we talk about a devotee, we have to understand what it means to be devoted. To be devoted means to be able to give yourself unto something unreservedly and completely, not selectively. So you must have the capacity to do that in the first place. The capacity to be devoted is not developed in devotional acts. It is developed in life. To be able to do one thing at one time with all of your heart, all of your mind, all of your soul, all of your enthusiasm. It is when you do that there that you can import or bring into your practices and be able to bring about a complete facing to your ideal, to give yourself completely to your ideal, and to be able to be devoted to it. We then spoke about a sthitaprajna. A sthitaprajna is one whose wisdom is steady. Wisdom is steady means that life or actions or our responses to things flows from it. What we know is what responds to life. It is not knowing high philosophy, but acting differently. I know what is good, but that doesn't make money. This won't work. I know what is good, but that doesn't seem to be... it's not going to cut it at this moment. That's selective. Then you don't know what is good. So a sthitaprajna, whose one is wisdom, is steady. Steady means everything flows from it, life flows from it, responses flows from it. A yoga brashta is one who has not reached the mark in yoga for whatever reason, in this current life or in previous lives. One thing that I had mentioned that I would like to repeat, the price of not walking on the path is greater than the sum of all falls experienced. To avoid making mistakes, I suggest four things. Firm conviction in the ideal, a good set of principles and precepts that support the goal, a leak-proof plan of living, and a system of self-accountability with an intelligent system of self-punishment. Mistakes are not the problem, not learning from them or repeating them is the problem. Then we spoke about a gunatita. Gunas are modes of the mind. There are three of them, sattva, rajas and tamas. And one who has mastery over the modes of the mind or who is not swayed by them is a gunatita. We took the example of a stream or a body of water and started with tamas. Tamas, when there is stagnancy or the water is stagnant, there is no movement, there is loss of visibility, and one cannot quite see things. There is also laziness in the personality, heedlessness, lethargy, darkness, sloth, indecision, inability to follow through. Rajas. When the water level and speed increases, it seeks the path of least resistance and flows to the vices and overflows from the bank. It is in this state that desires and passion, along with strong feelings about things, overwhelm us. If we have an Achilles heel, that Achilles heel will be nourished, or a weak spot will be nourished, when rajas is strong. Sattva is purity, balance, light. When the flow is just right, all areas get irrigated, there is no spillage. One can see through it, one is clear, one is focused, one is resolved, and has strong willpower. We also said that the inner drama is more dangerous than the outer drama, because when there is an outer circumstance or situation, there is a reason to control it or to get a handle on things. But one can be on their own and bubble and boil internally. It is here that we strengthen our vices and also experience them doubly. Now, the nature of equal vision. One has to rise to the nature of the sort, which is one, homogeneous and same. Remember what happens in meditation to understand how slippery the path is. Therefore, do one thing at one time, with all of your heart, with all of your soul, at home and everywhere, without any preference or priority, not my people and my kit or my kin or nothing like that. All are yours. He who you seek is in all as all. And therefore, one has to rise above the I, me, mine, and more. This requires unremitting or unrelenting vigilance to be able to see and know the ways of the mind and your own distinctness from this. This is called vicharana. Krishna tells us that one with equal vision is the highest yogi. Friends, thank you for joining me today in the second video. To download this video or its audio or PDF summary, kindly visit suryadevananda.org. Thank you.